from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The ancient story in the Bible's Book of Job reminds us that terrible things happen to good people. In Job's case, really terrible things, and lots of them. So hard and so bad, G.K. Chesterton wrote, that it would tempt God to atheism. There are hard, almost impossible lessons here for believers and unbelievers alike about justice, injustice, suffering, and the human condition. It all resonates right now. This hour On Point, the Book of Job and the hard side of life. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Have you needed the patience of Job, been up against the suffering and wondered why? How can this be? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from New York is Mark Larimore, professor of religious studies at the New School. He is author of the just-released The Book of Job, a biography. It's part of a series of Lives of Great Religious books out of Princeton. They've looked at the Dead Sea Scrolls, the Book of Mormon, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, Dietrich Bonhoeffer's Letters and Papers from Prison, the I Ching, this time the Book of Job. A biography. It's a terrific book and looks at how thinkers, people, have struggled with this story and its pain across the centuries. Mark Larimore in New York, thank you very much for joining us today.
It's my great pleasure.
It all begins with a wager. Remind us.
Yes, well, God says to Satan, have you noticed my servant Job? He is so very good. We have to ask ourselves why God points this out to the Satan, as we call him, the advocate. But Satan says, he's only good because you, he's only pious, he only praises you because you treat him well. Take everything away and he will curse you to your face. So God lets Satan take things away, one after another, Job does not curse.
He stays faithful in that way, but he suffers, his friends come and they turn out to be strange friends. The suffering is unbelievable. Describe what Job goes through. I mean, he's supposed to be he's a wealthy man in a land called Uz, I guess.
That's right.
Big family, huge flocks, blameless, upright, always careful to avoid doing evil. This is the paragon. And then the suffering? Describe it.
Okay. So first he loses his flocks, one after another. Then all 10 of his children are killed at once. Fire comes from heaven, destroys a building in which they are having a feast. All these messages are brought to Job at much the same time, although different versions sort of space them out.
Yeah.
But in very short order, Job loses everything, all of his wealth, his entire family, his future, his social position. When his friends come to find him, they don't recognize him because, in fact, his body is so completely transformed by illness and pain that he's unrecognizable. And he becomes a non-person.
As much as a non-person. You write about this as a book that looks at injustice, a book that looks at the suffering of the innocent, which he apparently was. It's clearly a test of faith here, but also a sort of broader examination of the human condition, that all of this can land on people for seemingly no reason. And then there we are, the patience of Job required.
Yes, I think actually that part of the power of this text is that everybody loses things. Everybody loses people they love. Everybody loses their expectations. Maybe in some broad sense, people lose their sense that the world makes sense. They lose their trust in their friends. They lose their trust in the way the world makes sense. And so Job is the person who speaks for and into that confusion, that despair, that panic.
And all those losses happen again and again, of course, through history, many of them happening around us right now all over the world. They're not hard to find. It may be in your life, dear listener. In your family's life right now, you can look at the country. You can pick your place abroad where the losses are horrible. I mean, just this morning on NPR, hearing stories about the suffering of refugee children in Syria, it can be kind of mind-boggling. This is the story in the Bible that focuses directly on that kind of suffering that just falls on people. This is a great book, Mark. It's just a dense fistful of a book. You had my mind going just page after page. Remind us where this story came from. It's kind of an odd book sitting in the Bible. What's its origin?
That's one of the things we wish we knew. If we knew, then we might be able to know what kind of a story it is. It shows up in the canon at a certain point. I'm actually most interested in the theory that it was a book that perhaps the people in charge of the religion didn't like. That it might actually have been written as a parody of these pious tales that said, oh, if you suffer, just stick with it. Things will come through.
Yeah, and well, watch this. Watch this.
Right. And Job says, or the author of Job says, well, that's not what suffering feels like. And that's not actually an attitude that we would want to recommend to people. And so somebody writes this beautiful, extraordinary poem, which somehow rings with a truth that none of the pious stories before that had. And then this text takes on a life of its own. And then maybe the priests and others finally said, well, if we can't beat them, join them. Let's co-opt it. Let's say, oh, yes, that's our story.
Who is this Job supposed to be? Does the rest of the Bible give us any clue about who this man is, how he fits into the whole biblical picture?
Virtually none. I mean, he's presented as a person who's not a part of the people of Israel. He's the greatest of the people in the East. We don't know who those people are. Interpreters in the past tried to locate him, tried to connect him in various ways to the story told in the rest of the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament. But in fact, the connection is very tenuous. My understanding is that the book of Job, or that Job stands outside of this history, and that's part of what makes him so real to us.
How did it get into the Bible then? And is it equally represented in the Torah, the Jewish text?
Yes, it's there. If we knew how it came into the Bible, again, that would help. We have different theories. As I suggested, my favorite theory is actually that it was a parody. It was a parody that turned out to be more true than the thing that it called into question.
You share speculation that this may be part of a tradition older than either of the faiths that read this, that it may go back to a wisdom tradition that's timeless. Nothing can be timeless, I guess, but very old indeed. What's that?
The wisdom tradition is a larger tradition during the several centuries before the Common Era in the Middle East, and it was a largely cosmopolitan intellectual tradition of people who asked questions about individual suffering and experience. They had a very general conception of divinity or of the human condition. They were not committed to particular religious traditions, but asked more general ones that speak to us now in our pluralistic age, when I think that individual experience tends to slip beyond whatever the languages of the religious traditions we were raised in.
At one point in the book of Job, God shows up and speaks from a whirlwind. What does he have to say for himself, herself?
He talks about everything except the questions that the book of Job raises. He certainly doesn't talk about the wager at the beginning. He doesn't address Job except to say, are you paying attention? He doesn't talk about human experience. He doesn't talk about justice. He talks about animals. He talks about stars. He talks about the cosmos. He talks about great and horrible destruction, all these things that he set into motion in creating the world. Famously asks Job, were you there when I did those things? But never, never does he address Job's questions.
Many find in it the Bible's deepest reflection on the meaning of suffering, often understood as the Bible's answer to the problem of evil. But the answer is not clear. I mean, these meditations have gone on for a long time. Take up suffering first. We'll get to evil. But suffering, it's not as though there's not suffering in other parts of the Bible. Is it the concentration that's here or the sort of randomness of it that makes it the heart of that contemplation?
Randomness is definitely part of it. Also, I think just the completeness of it, as you said. So it's not just the loss of family, not just the loss of a future, not just the loss of your wealth, not just the loss of your social station, not just the loss of your friends, but loss in every way, not just the loss of your health. Everything gets lost at once. So in that way, it is sort of the epitome of suffering. It's the coming together of every possible kind of suffering that people endure.
G.K. Chesterton saying he thought even God was tempted to atheism in the book of Job. What's he pulling on there?
Well, God gets cornered into this wager, depending how you read it, but God really doesn't want to be afflicting Job. Job is his favorite person. And somehow God has got himself into this fix in which he's pointed Job out to the prosecuting attorney of the divine court and says, see, here's my best person. And the prosecuting attorney says, no, he's only good because you treat him well. If you don't put him to the test, we'll never know if his faith is genuine. And so God is almost cornered, almost tricked into, almost forced into testing, tormenting his most beloved servant.
It's been a tough book for the most orthodox interpreters of it, you write. They have an especially hard
yes.
time with it. Job says things that are hard for them to accept. And the pious friends who come around, to turn out to not be very admirable.
Absolutely not. But my own understanding of the book of Job is that most of the book of Job is Job's exchanges with his friends. So his friends have to be friends. Otherwise, he wouldn't be so destroyed by their failure to sympathize, by their unwillingness to listen to him. So they represent not just all the reigning views about why God does what God does, why people suffer as they do, But they are Job's closest friends. They're speaking for his own best understanding of the human predicament.
But that turns out to be inadequate. God turns around and condemns all that pious stuff.
Absolutely, yes. And instead, Job is held up. Job is spoken rightly.
Spoken rightly, held up. By what do you mean by that? I mean, in the end, in the most commonly read version, he's restored his wealth. He has a family again. But is that what you mean by held up?
Well, God speaks in the whirlwind, and although he doesn't talk about the human condition, he addresses Job. And then at the end, he turns to Job's friends and says, "You have not spoken rightly, as has my servant Job." And then he asks Job to conduct a sacrifice for his friends, and then Job's life is restored. Eventually, he gets everything back in double, except for his children, but we're told that his new daughters are more beautiful than the last ones. But the friendships are the first things that are restored.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the book of Job, about the suffering of innocence and injustice, test of faith, about the ancient Bible story and its resonance across time. And right now, Mark Larimore is with us. He's author of the new book, The Book of Job, a biography, which looks at how people have read this amazing ancient story, kind of an oddball in the Bible, but very much there and magnetic over its entire life in the minds of humans. Mark Larimore, there's a part in here where Job discovers that the suffering of the innocent is just everywhere. Yes. I wonder if you might share some of that reading for us. I think this is from the Bible, the New Revised Standard Version of the Bible. Of course, so many versions. But it's just this litany of the suffering that we can see in the world. He frames it in God. Of course, the Bible does. But you can see the suffering no matter how you look at it. Could you read some from that
verse?
Sure.
Okay, this is from chapter 24, and it's taken 23 chapters for Job to realize that his suffering actually is shared beyond his own experience. But then when his eyes open, he suddenly sees nothing but suffering everywhere and says, "Why are times not kept by the Almighty? And why do those who know him never see his days? The wicked remove landmarks. They seize flocks and pasture them. They drive away the donkey of the orphan. They take the widow's ox for a pledge. They thrust the needy off the road. The poor of the earth all hide themselves like wild asses in the desert. They go out to their toil, scavenging in the wasteland, food for their young. They reap in a field not their own, and they glean in the vineyard of the wicked. They lie all night naked without clothing and have no covering in the cold. They are wet with rain of the mountains and cling to the rock for want of shelter. There are those who snatch the orphan child from the breast and take as a pledge the infant of the poor. They go about naked, without clothing. Though hungry, they carry the sheaves. Between their terraces, they press out oil. They tread the wine presses, but suffer thirst. From the city, the dying groan, and the throat of the wounded cries for help. Yet God pays no attention to their prayers."
That is quite a litany. So, in interpretation, how wide's it been over the centuries that people have read this? I mean, in all times, we look around and see suffering. And yet this has been interpreted different ways and used in different ways by different people in different times, Mark.
Yes. Well, so this is, you mentioned before that the book of Job is particularly troubling for Orthodox people in some ways. Certainly a passage like this is one that seems to call out a God who is entirely negligent. It seems to suggest that God's care for his creation or his human creation is delinquent. So
is there a counter voice to that and say, "Oh, no, it's fine"? See, Job shows that he's really on the job.
Well, that's the drama of it, because his friends all come in and say, "Oh, no, you're not seeing these things right. You've got things back to front, blah, 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 blah." But in fact, Job is the one who sort of seeing these things through the crucible of his own suffering suddenly comes to understand that God's relationship to the world isn't a relationship of somebody who takes care of every detail. It must be something else. This isn't a happy discovery. And then the God who appears to him is that God who doesn't attend to every detail of human life, at least not in the ways in which human beings expect.
Jung,
so in some ways, these questions remain unaddressed.
Jung says that God suffers a moral defeat at Job's hands. What did Jung mean by that?
I love that passage, yes. So Jung thought that God had so abased himself by testing the most moral person, had shown himself, God's self, to be capable of doing such arbitrary and capricious things, that at the end of the story, the moral paragon is no longer God, but Job. Sort of a moment at which God loses, Job wins.
And there's almost a sort of rationale for the Christian story in here. You write, it suffered such a moral defeat at Job's hands that he, God, had to assume human form and sacrifice himself in order to recoup.
Exactly. Yes. So for Jung, there's a kind of a deficit that's introduced into biblical monotheism at this point, where God has so lost credibility that he has to do something absolutely dramatic to regain control. And in fact, because Job, the human being, has now become the moral paragon, the only way God can recover God's own credibility is by taking human form. And so the incarnation of God in human form is his way of trying to get back to where he started, having created in Job somebody who is more perfect than himself.
And yet, in Christianity, maybe the most common reference to all this comes in the burial liturgy, very common burial liturgy, where we hear, you know, the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. That sounds like fatalism. Or is it something else?
It certainly sounded like fatalism to a lot of people. But I think it might actually contain something else. There's some kind of a sense that God has God's own reasons. So often people have thought that the book of Job is about a God whose justice takes a long time, a God who may test his beloved, but ultimately comes around to acting in the way in which human beings expect, rewarding the good with happiness, punishing the wicked with suffering. But the book of Job really doesn't tell us that that's what's going on at all. God's reasons are entirely different. In the wager, God is involved in goodness knows what kind of interior monologue. He never explains that. In the divine speeches, he talks about all the other things besides the human world that he's concerned with. At the end, he gives Job back all these things that he had before, and Job continues as he was before. But all the big questions, as I mentioned, remain unaddressed.
Different ways of looking at this, starting just with religious, but not only those. But you say there are distinct Jewish and Christian ways of reading Scripture and reading Job in particular. What's the distinction in this book?
In this book, it might be easier to come at it from the Christian side. The Christian side, even if you don't take the Jungian view, is that Job, like every other book in the Christian Old Testament, points towards Christ. And so Christ is the key to the book of Job. And Christian readings have, until quite recently, focused on Job as a prefiguration of Christ, a sort of a representation of Christ before the Christ event, showing what Christ's experience would be like. And so Job's suffering points to somebody who experiences all the suffering possible for human beings in one place, and that then anticipates the God-man who then takes this suffering upon himself.
And the Jewish handling of this book?
The Jewish handling is much more careful because Job asks very, very difficult questions, and Job is presented as a non-Hebrew. So what do you do with this man? He's more eloquent in some ways than most of your other voices, and yet he's a stranger. How do you make him part of your intellectual life? And I found over the course of my researches that, in fact, although protest is a much more important part of, I think, Jewish religiosity than of Christian religiosity, in the history of worship, for example, Job is much less important for Jewish liturgies and traditions than it is for Christians.
The patience of Job has also made it deep into popular culture, this phrase, but you look at this and remind us that what's often been seen here is not patience in a sense of acquiescence, a kind of patience that may include protest, even rage, a kind of pre-modern patience that we may not understand well these days.
Yes, that's actually one of the things that I hope people take from my book. There's a tendency these days to think of the book of Job as two books that have been sort of wrapped around each other. One story about a very pious person who just takes everything sitting down and says, oh, God does what God does. And another one who speaks truth to power. But the history of the reading of the book of Job didn't have the option of separating it out in these ways. And instead, you had the sense that the same person who takes things as they are, succumbs, acquiesces at the end, is the same person who protests. The idea of the patience of Job actually comes not from the book of Job itself, but from a Christian scripture, the Epistle of James. And a number of people have taken to thinking about the frame story in which Job doesn't complain as the story of the patient Job, and the central part of the book of Job, which is written in poetry, unlike the outside framework, as the story of the impatient Job. But I think it's been one of the things I've learned from working on this project is that there is a kind of patience that expresses itself in all of the rage and all of the eloquence and all of the despair, but in the persistent demand for meaning that Job represents that he expresses in his poems.
And for those who are not Jewish or Christian, or maybe those who aren't drawn to religious faith at all. What about the message there? That's surely another modern reading.
I think that one of the things that drew me to the book of Job, since most of my interlocutors are secular intellectuals as I am, is that Job is atheists' favorite book of the Bible. And in one way, atheists might like it because in it they think that God shows God's true colors. But there's also a sense in which it presents a question that is, as you suggested, prior to religion. There's something fundamental in human experience, a fundamental question that comes from suffering, from the pervasiveness of suffering, from the inability to see any kind of moral thing going on in human history. The wrong people suffer. The wrong people prosper. The projects of the best people fail. The projects of the worst people flourish. And this seems to be something that's true whether you're a religious person or not.
Response from our listeners here. It's all over the place. Bobby says it's about faith. Daphne says it's about one immature, sick deity. And then Phyllis says this, Mark, says the book of Job is a cop-out. When Job, a good man, asks God why he's been made to suffer, God doesn't answer. Instead, he asks Job, who do you think you are? Can you move a mountain? Can you create a whale? The book of Job, our listener writes, should not be in the Bible. It teaches people not to question but to accept their fate. Bad news for humans who want to act as the sparks of God's life and make this a better world, Phyllis says. What do you say to that, Mark?
Amen to that.
Should not be in the Bible? Bad news for humans?
Well, I'm not sure that it's bad news for humans. I think in some ways it may be humans' finest moment. But it's certainly bad news for human religion, for a kind of a religion which sort of assumes that the world is made in our image, that we are the main character in the story, that our flourishing and our happiness and our understanding are entirely adequate ways of conceiving why the world exists.
I want to get to our listeners and their questions and their view. David in Port Wing, Wisconsin. David, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Job is all our lives on fast forward. From birth, humans are in the process of losing everything. Job loses everything all at once and presumably gets to do it twice.
Because he's restored and then has to face, of course, mortality once again at the end, David.
Exactly.
So all of our suffering in fast forward is a lot to take. Is it? How do you look at it? Is it a sustaining story, a depressing story? Does it bolster faith, diminish it, or is that not even where you look at it?
Well, his integrity is what's kept up. His friends are asking him to pretend to know more than he knows. They're saying God couldn't possibly be doing this to you if you hadn't done something wrong. And Job refuses to pretend to know more than he knows. He keeps asking questions. And in the end, his integrity is held up.
His integrity, and he certainly sticks with it. David, thank you for that. One more, Peter in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Peter, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
Well, there was one thing for me with Job. I've come out of a sort of an Episcopal agnostic believer, if that makes a shred
okay.
of sense. But back during the AIDS years, I lost half my friends. Mm-hmm. And God didn't intervene. You know, nothing helped. Mm-hmm. And I turned to J.B., the play by Archibald MacLeish, where Job wound up forgiving God for not being perfect, you know, whether you were in a universe that didn't give a bloody heck, or whether it was a plot by some higher level of perception. Hmm. But he forgave God and then spoke to his wife in the darkness and said, "We shall blow on the coal of the heart, and we shall see by and by." And that absolutely did it for me, because if God is present or exists, he is going to be within the community, and how we empathetically care for one another despite the evil that comes and the losses that must come just in the process of living.
The care in the community. I so appreciate your call, Peter. Mark Larimore, this seems to be somewhere near where I read you in the end looking at this book. And you remind us, Job was indeed very important during the height of the HIV/AIDS crisis. Lots of people looked here.
Yes. Actually, thank you for both of those comments. I think that David's comment really resonates very powerfully with the way in which the book of Job is experienced by people who grew up with it or encounter it at some point. They know that suffering doesn't happen all at once and ends. They know that sometimes something good comes out of something bad, not often, not all the time, not reliably, not predictably, but even then another suffering will come. I had the pleasure of reading through the book of Job with a group of homeless people a few years ago, and that's how they read the book of Job. They said, "Oh, so at the end he's up for a while. We know he'll be down again. We know he'll be down again." And that's why Job speaks to us.
Is that a comfort or just a sense of of finding a stability with reality? What is that?
I think there is a comfort there, and I've struggled to make sense of it myself. I've learned a lot from the people who I study in my book, but I think there is a kind of a comfort that comes in Job's persistence, in his persistent demand for meaning. And to connect with what Peter was saying, and actually I'm really glad that he mentioned Archibald MacLeish's J.B. because my first experience with the Book of Job was acting in that play in high school. I wasn't God. I wasn't Job. Mm. I wasn't Satan, Mr. Nichols. I wasn't the friends. I was just the messenger.
Okay. But you were in the midst of it. Mark Larimore's book is The Book of Job, a biography looking at how this very hard story has been understood across the centuries. Mark, stand by in New York. With me right now in the studio is Greg Epstein. He's the humanist chaplain at Harvard University, trained as a humanist rabbi, author of Good Without God, What a Billion Non-Religious People Do Believe. Greg Epstein, thanks very much for joining us. Here's a tough book, let's say, for those who are humanists, who aren't looking at this through a religious prism. What do you find in it? Is it valuable?
Thanks, Tom. It's always an honor to be with you. And yes, this book is a quintessentially human story. It's a story about our suffering, and we all suffer. Every human being suffers because we suffer because we care. We care about our lives. We care about our health, and yet we're mortal and we're vulnerable. We care about each other. But our relationships are so unpredictable and they're so fallible.
It could be a nihilist story then. Don't care, because caring brings you into suffering.
Well, I mean, that's one way to interpret it. But I prefer the idea that, you know, this is a book that really did grapple with the fact that easy explanations for suffering, pat answers for suffering, are no good.
But even though God doesn't play a very benevolent role here, at least it gives a context to this. Take God out of this, and for the non-religious, mm-hmm. what's the lesson in all the suffering?
Well, I was ordained as a secular humanist rabbi, and what Mark described earlier as his favorite theory about what the book of Job actually represents in history is actually basically what we were taught as humanist rabbis, as rabbis for the non-religious. We were taught that what makes most sense, historically speaking, and actually ethically speaking, is that even as in ancient times there were people who had a very orthodox sounding or seeming message that, you know, that you should obey God and God knows and God sets the rules, etc., there have always been skeptics who've thought, no, there's got to be a better way, that this type of God that would test his character, Job, in this way, that would capitulate to this dare from Satan, from his prosecuting attorney, mm-hmm. that's not a good God. And so we've got to have better answers. We human beings have to answer our own questions because we can't look to a deity to do so.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the Book of Job, about the suffering of innocence, about injustice, about the ancient Bible story and its resonance across time. And right now, Mark Larimore is with us this hour, author of The Book of Job, a biography. He's professor of religious studies at the New School, joins us from New York. With me in the studio, humanist chaplain at Harvard University, Greg Epstein, author of Good Without God. It is an incredible story of a virtuous man, a man who had everything going, had it all stripped away from him just brutally. His wealth, his flocks, his 10 children, all taken. Then plagued just with one suffering after another. Hard to understand. A story kind of on its own in the Bible, one that has attracted philosophers and religious thinkers across time. Mark Larimore writes about all that in his book. Mark, Greg, all kinds of response online. I mean, it's just an incredible range here. You know, here's Ed. What a wonderful book Job is, showing the faithfulness of God. In a way, but it's a cosmic path to get there. Richard says, Job was my father's favorite. He was raised poor and with much loss. Speaking to who has suffered, it reassures the disenfranchised. Not everybody's quite so sure. Ryan writes, it's immoral and irrational to exalt Job. What omniscient God would need to test a human when that God should already know the outcome? What benevolent God would allow the suffering and death of a man and his family just to test his faith on a bet that an omniscient God would already know the outcome of? Ryan says the Bible's a myth, not a moral or a lifestyle handbook. What about Job? I mean, you've touched on it, Mark, but across time, how people have handled this, those who see Job, the book of Job, as a challenge to God himself.
Yes. those, again, are fantastic responses. There's a bunch of different things. Sorry.
How have people looked at that? You know, our caller Ryan is saying, look, if you look at this story, and it's a story that rings true. This could happen. So, and this is on a bet. So, mm-hmm. You know, it goes to the faith itself. And some people interpret it as an affirmation, some as a disputation.
Yes. To me, the wager is the most difficult part of the book to make sense of. But I am interested in one way of trying to answer the question that God shouldn't have to test Job to know what Job's true mettle is. Mm-hmm. And that answer is that God knows, but Job doesn't. That there are things that Job needs to learn about himself. And maybe there are things that we need to learn about human experience through the experience of people like Job. That said, I can think of nothing more monstrous than those views that say, oh, the death of your child was God's message to teach you something. So there are many problematic parts of the book of Job, but there are answers that have been offered to these questions throughout the tradition.
Greg Epstein, how's a humanist look at that kind of learning? Hey, I'll teach you something. I'll teach you what the death feels like, the death of 10 children feels like.
Right.
I'll teach you what disease feels like, you know, lose everything. I'll teach you what that feels like. People go through these things.
Yeah.
How's a humanist look at them?
There's something really terrible about this idea that suffering is supposed to teach us something, that suffering is sent from on high to teach us a lesson. Because as you said, a teacher of mine once said, in fact, that sometimes the nicest thing you can say about God is that he doesn't exist, that these are just stories that our ancestors created to help them think about these terrible questions of why is life so painful. And we've actually answered a lot of suffering. We've made life in some ways less full of suffering. The world is actually in some ways less violent and more certain than
with medicine, with peace efforts.
Yes, exactly. I mean,
but still, suffering goes on such a scale.
There's so much suffering. And so, you know, still to comfort somebody today who's suffering by saying, you know, that your suffering has a meaning from on high is terribly problematic. However, there is this idea that tempts us all to think, well, you know, there's sometimes a real silver lining to our dark cloud. You know, when I go through this or when members of my own humanist community congregation go through suffering, we do sometimes learn a great deal from it. Sometimes we do get stronger because of the things that we've had to suffer through. But from my point of view, it's not that there's some magical, mystical silver lining floating above us that we just have to pull down from the sky. What I'm thankful for through suffering is my own strength, my own hope, my own ability to grow that was given to me by other people. You know, I am the beneficiary of other people who've loved me and cared about me enough that sometimes I may be able to grow from my suffering. And so when people suffer, I say, you know, let's try to have gratitude for the strength we have inside of ourselves to persevere, to push through our suffering.
Let me challenge some of that for a minute here. You say, you know, this is terrible, terrible for all this suffering to be imposed. And yet, leave God out of it, if you like, for a moment. The suffering is there.
Yes.
And it always has been there. And it's deep. It's unbearable to see.
Yes.
You know, maybe there's something in this story which, as Mark writes, may predate or be quite apart from actual a religious tradition, maybe part of a quote-unquote wisdom tradition, that says, look, you, even your community may not want to look at it, but there's suffering and it's deep, and it exists God or no God. I mean, terrible can mean all kinds of things. You could say the universe is terrible in the sense of awesome or cosmic, in a kind of Lincoln-esque use of the word. Is there value in this story opening our eyes to that? We're sentient creatures. We're capable and therefore required to grapple with that fact.
And we can make sense now of aspects of the universe that the authors of this text did not know about. We know now that we're products of the Big Bang. We know that we're the children of evolution. We know that we trace our ancestry back to single-celled organisms that billions of years ago began to reproduce by eating one another and by sexual reproduction.
Does all that make the philosophical challenge of dealing with suffering any less?
No. What it does is it tells us that there is no one answer from on high, and that we are responsible to face the suffering. It's not going away. The only way to eliminate suffering in life would either be to die, and I don't wish early death on myself or anyone in this world, or to stop caring. And I disagree, and I think humanism is a philosophy that disagrees with the idea that we should just stop caring. There's a musical that some of my students put on called Next to Normal that I think really gets at this. It's about a woman who's suffering terribly from mental illness, part of which is brought on from her son dying at a very early age. And she's really suffering. And it ends with a beautiful song that has the lyric, "The price of love is pain, and still we pay. We love anyway." And I think that although in many of our lives that's not quite enough, it really is something that we can hold on to, that we suffer because we love one another and we care about one another and we care about life. And we would pay that price in order to be alive. I would.
Let's go to John, a caller from Waterbury, Connecticut. Greg Epstein, thank you. John in Waterbury, you're on the air.
Hey.
What do you think, John?
How's it going? I was just kind of building on kind of what people were saying. There are kind of two ways to look at this. God can be looked at as kind of a fatalistic through fatalism, that, you know, God is some, like, God causes good. But, you know, we're even told in Scripture as Christians who believe in, you know, the gospel, that God causes the rain to fall equally on the unjust and the just. Personally, in short, I think that the book of Job is a marvelous testimony to what being human means. And I say that, you know, as someone studying to become a priest, the idea of God and his nature, like, God, are you good? Is this God a good God? Is something that truly speaks of faith, because religions can tell you God is good. Well, partially, you kind of have to find out for yourself.
The book of Job tells you that God is good somehow, John?
Yes, it
How?
Does. Because
How?
I look at it as the book of Job tells you that God is open to an idea of conversation. You're given the option by Job's wife. What does Job's wife say? Curse God and die. Well, I look at it as Job is really a man of faith, not in the passive sense, because that passive sense isn't where the movement of faith is. The real movement of faith is Job questioning.
John, we've got it. Our time is short. I appreciate your call. Mark Larimore, yes, indeed. His wife says, look, this is so bad. Why don't you just curse God and die? It'd be better. He sticks around. Our caller, Mark, calls that a conversation. Now, I suppose it is depicted in some way, but, you know, I mean, all that suffering is some literally hell of a conversation.
It's a hell of a conversation. But interpreters have said that perhaps the most amazing thing that happens in the book of Job, given the things that God winds up saying in his speeches, where human beings don't seem to be a very important part of the picture, is that God speaks to a human being about that. That God chooses Job as an interlocutor, as a conversation partner for that sharing. Well, it is, as you said, not much of a conversation.
Well, you better be brave when you get into a conversation with the Almighty there. You remind us that it's been read in quite different ways politically. Job. The Bible's found, people have found here the most, Bible's most moving descriptions of oppression and some of its most disdainful representations of the poor. But then you say, reading Job with his impoverished community in Lima, Peruvian liberation theologian Gustavo Gutierrez found it a primer on how to speak of God from the heart of poverty and communal oppression. On the other hand, you write, others have suggested that the story of Job can only have been written by and for the wealthy. The ubiquitous encomia to the text's sublimity, always talking about, oh, it's so sublime and it's so difficult, reveal it, you write, to be an ideological work that channels questions about the cause and meaning of oppression and inequality away from the political realm. Don't think about your suffering politically. Think about this as a conversation with God. It's amazing it can be read in those two ways around this political field, Mark.
Absolutely. So I think the Book of Job, and that's an argument that David Clines makes in a fascinating article called Why Is There a Book of Job and What Does It Do to You When You Read It? And his argument is that the Book of Job would only have survived if wealthy people or people who had access to writing cared about it enough to get it recopied enough times that it found its way into the texts. But he also looks very carefully at the way in which Job describes poverty, and we just read the one passage in which the poor are described in the most extreme way. But David Clines' view is that that's the way the poor look to the rich. The rich can't actually imagine
naked
the life of the poor
and unsheltered and pitiful, miserable.
Yes. That in fact that's the great anxiety of the wealthy who know that might not always be so, and they don't know how to make a life without wealth. And so they imagine the absolute destruction of everything. So it's the nightmare of the rich to lose everything, to lose your social station. That only people who already have everything and know how precarious it is would even enjoy the fantasy that somebody had everything, lost everything, and got it back.
Kind of a horror flick.
Exactly.
With that kind of gratification. Martin, Greg, what are you thinking as you hear this?
I want to speak first to the idea that God somehow honors Job by having this brief conversation with him. I mean, I would think that if I, to my children or to my staff, you know, put them through this kind of suffering to test them or to prove a theory about my good work or my justice or whatever, and then I said to them, well, but at least I'm willing to talk to you for a few minutes from a whirlwind and not even answer your questions, I would think that they would say that I was a terribly bad father or bad manager. I mean, this is not an ideal model of justice. What it is it's a thought-provoking set of questions. You know, what
but it's
about
God, after all? I mean, if you take that in some ways as a synonym for the cosmos,
yeah.
You expect the cosmos to sit down over checkers and really talk about it in detail? You expect more than some kind of, you know...
No, I don't, but that's why I don't worship the cosmos. I mean, that's why I respect the fact that I am one small part, one infinitesimal part of the cosmos, but I don't bow down to worship it. Because it hasn't been the most respectful to us as a species at times. What about Job's wife, this poor woman who has her children taken away from her, who has her whole world taken away from her, who has her husband taken away from her? She gets one line in the entire thing. A colleague of mine, another humanist rabbi, Adam Shalom, gave a sermon that gives voice to Job's wife, that speaks from her point of view. Because it's just one example of the fact that this is not the literature that we would want to write today. It's classic, great literature. It's influential. But I would like to think that if we wrote the Bible again today, we would give Job's wife more than one line.
Yeah, she shares the suffering. Mark Larimore, you look at this and people's understanding, humans' understanding over time. Has this difficult story become easier or more difficult to understand with time, with the passage of centuries, millennia?
In some ways, I think it has become more difficult because we have become more committed to – the world has become an easier place to be at home. Modern technology, science, better social systems make us feel more comfortable in the world. We experience the world as a place that the human could actually find a home. And so when in fact we don't, when we become homeless in this world, it causes a greater crisis for us. But there's one thing I wanted to say just in response to the discussion up till now, which I think is quite important. One argument for why the Book of Job might have happened and why it might have been included is that it's the only proof given within Scripture that suffering doesn't have a meaning all the time, that the innocent suffer. And Paul Ricoeur, an important phenomenologist of religion, had this very interesting account that suffering actually is experienced as punishment, that when people suffer, that the experience of suffering itself feels like punishment. So that there's nothing within human experience to convince us when we're suffering terribly that we don't in some way deserve it. But what the Book of Job does is it says suffering is not deserved. Innocent suffering is something that human beings, that happens to a lot of human beings. So you could look at this religiously and say it is in this book that God tells human beings that suffering often has no meaning, is unwarranted, that you are innocent.
And
or you could say that human beings came up with this story to affirm their own sense of innocence.
And Greg, in this, finds a path toward unbelieving. What about the path toward faith here, an affirmation of faith in this story? How's that described, Mark?
Well, Job persists. Calvin, who has a very interesting take on the Book of Job, says that the proof of God's existence is that Job doesn't give up. That Job's persistence is actually God's persistence, that Job's willingness to continue to hope, willingness to seek an answer, willingness to try and understand things that seem to defy him, actually shows access to something that's superhuman.
people pull it out in tough times, in times that seem chaotic. They may be pulling it out this week, Mark. will they find sustenance there? I guess they got to have a pretty big game on to find it. I mean, comfort there? You've got to be thinking very, very broad to find comfort here.
Yes. It's definitely strong medicine.
It's strong.
But we need that.
Strong medicine in the book of Job in a time of trial. It's great to review it. Mark Larimore's new book is The Book of Job, a biography. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much. It's been a wonderful conversation.
And Greg Epstein, humanist, chaplain at Harvard University. Thank you so much for joining us, Greg.
Thank you. This has been about faith in caring for one another. That's humanist faith. Thank you very much, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.